Okay, well, I guess I'm going to go ahead and get started here. I have to apologize to everyone in advance. Our team has been very focused in on getting our data together for delivery. It's a Spitzer Legacy program. So we aren't quite as far along in doing the science as some of the other teams, but perhaps you can focus and get us a boost in the right direction. There is going to be a special session at the AAAS in Austin about forest surveys, and we have a bunch of folks who are going to be getting ready for that. But this is sort of where we are, and perhaps not quite as self-confident as folks on here. Here are just a list of team members. I'm sure I've left someone out somewhere, but you can see it's very international. We have folks from Japan and Switzerland and France, so forth. The folks in red are the ones who've been working on the data reduction team. So the goals here were pretty obvious. Everyone knows Taurus. It's got more references in ADS than any of the other star-forming regions. So our idea was, before Spitzer goes at least cryogenically belly up in a year or so, to get a reasonable fraction of the Taurus molecular cloud complex map with the imaging instruments on board IRAC and MIPS in order to take a census, as it were, of things with disks, at the very least, brown dwarfs and stars in that area, and determine whether, and to what extent there are stars with disks lurking about in areas outside of the known aggregates that have been very well mapped with the small format infrared cameras from the ground. Also to look for more examples of what Neil calls the cold disks, the transitional type and low disk luminosity disks that perhaps were not seen by all sky surveys such as IRAS because they lack the sensitivity to look for such things. And also to do a cross-identification of our mid-infrared sources with optical, near-infrared, even X-ray sources from some of the other large surveys that now exist. So our mapping strategy with Spitzer had to be to take time as of the essence. In other words, that we don't have as deep a coverage or as redundant a coverage over our Taurus maps as many of the other surveys do. In fact, we decided that since we're right in the ecliptic plane with Taurus, we had to map twice to eliminate asteroids from our catalog. But for IRAC, which is a relatively inefficient mapping instrument, we only had time to take two frames per point, one in each of our observing epochs. We had 12 seconds for each with a shorter exposure along. Because it was such a large area and we were coming back trying to fill in gaps and so forth, we didn't quite fill in everywhere, as you can see. So here is the first Taurus program was only to map about 30 square degrees of the main Taurus clouds. Here are the 13 CO maps from long ago, not the beautiful ones that Paul was showing you. But this was sort of the coverage as it existed in these long strips for MIPS. And this down here are AOR footprints on top of the Taurus clouds on a 100 micron IRAS map. And you can see here, these are more or less the sensitivities that we achieve, and this is in millijanseys. So at 24, we're about 1 or 1.5 millijanseys, and much, much better than that for IRAC, despite the fact that we're only hitting it with two individual frames that are pretty short in integration time. So a couple of cycles ago, we got more time to come back and get some of this area more L1495 part of the cloud and to fill out the L1536 part of the cloud, and that was done earlier this year, and so we're trying to bring all of that together. And in total, we have about 44 square degrees, which is a lot of territory. So this is just an example of what pops out of the pipeline in IRAC. When you put together some of the colors, this is 3.6, 4.5, and 8 microns. You can see some of the PA emission in the red at 8 microns. You can see some young stars in this area and some nebulosity, and we'll zoom up a bit on this. This is the protostar in L1527, which is kind of a neat source, and you can see it's got some HH objects flying up out of it here. And this is something that in the K-band, you can just barely see it, even as deep as you want to go. And here's a little deeper image. The actual source is starting to pop out at 8 microns here, and this is a very embedded source. Here's an HH object that's coming out from this region, but very far away from it. And in fact, we have discovered some new parsec scale Herbig Haro flows in the clouds just because we have this wide area. So just to put it in place here, here's the usual diagram, and here are some Hubble pictures of edge on disk to kind of fill in the blanks for the different stages of SED evolution. And up here we have something that's, you know, class 0/1, or at least it's usually considered as such. Of course, it's edge on, so that puts another wrinkle into how you interpret the SED, but at least we can have a fairly complete picture of how these things look with Spitzer's help to get the more embedded objects. And this is just a picture combining bands 1/4 and MIPS 24 microns in the middle of the Taurus molecular cloud.
Did you is that barking dark thing a real cloud?
That is a real cloud, yes. It's sort of like a fishhook that goes around here, and it is even dark at 24 microns. Now, if you go into the MIPS Gal survey of the galactic plane, they have some dark clouds that are dark at 70 microns. This is what Neil was calling shadow. Where you have, in this case, the PA emission, the green stuff, in the background that is giving you a silhouette for a very high
Do I have no feeling for how big this picture is? Do you know how big that thing is?
This thing is about 20 arc minutes, something like that.
Well, they must have appeared, you know, from the optical station.
Yeah. I think it's in that region.
I think it's straight.
Yeah, it's something around right over here. So this is, when we put together, this is sort of the first 28 square degrees of the 24 micron map. It's really dominated by zodiacal emission. I mean, we're right in the middle of the zodi. Interestingly, this is one of the B stars that's not supposed to be in Taurus. And here's another one over here, and there's one up here. And they do a pretty good job of lighting up the nebulosity for things that are not supposed to be
right in.
I will show you where the shell, the cavity was. And here's, this is again the 24 micron, you can see that hook around one of the B stars there. So when we go through, and in each frame we subtract out what the model predicts the zodiacal emission should be, we get this picture. This is the 30 square degrees of the Taurus 1 survey, and we get this bright feature going across here. And what's that? And we don't know what's illuminating it. We can see some diffuse nebulosity. It ends up, what does get rid of it is going through and getting a more detailed model of the asteroidal dust bands in the zodiacal emission. We've got such a huge, I mean, some of these, this is 6 degrees. One end to the other right here. And so we get these large scale features in the ecliptic plane. So when we subtract out the Zodi band, then we can start to see false cavity right here, even in the 24 micron emission.
That's a technical question. How do you get such a detailed model? I mean, you really must know that then on arcminute scales, right? To subtract that's how it looked here.
Yes, it's more on a, it's at least a degree wide.
Yeah.
So it's pretty large.
It's not that you subtract the little wrinkles on it. That's how it looked on the first book.
Right. So, no, I mean, it's a very smooth model that we, of a uniform thing that's with the width of about.
I was impressed. Yeah, mechanics.
But there is small scale emission in the
Yes, there is, but we aren't really seeing those kind of features. We haven't subtracted anything out, and that what happened with that is that it just brought out features that are already there, and you'll see them very well in the stretch, but it's just making this part of the map much brighter than the other parts.
All the little features
are really a part of TARS. I mean, they really are features in the dust emission at 24 microns, small grains.
So it's effectively some weird image stretch caused by
exactly. So it's just enhancing the light coming through at that point. So here's just to demonstrate, this is the eye chart. For those of you who haven't had to go and find asteroids, I used to work with Gene Shoemaker as a grad student, so I had to play this for real. But I can tell you there are many more asteroids in this picture than I ever saw with pictures from the 18-inch SMIT. And in fact, one of the first bits of science that we got done from the TARS survey is to say that at 24 microns, and down to a Milojansky, we're at about 250 asteroids per square degree. So as you can see, at 24 microns, more than half of the point sources are asteroids.
But at least they move, right?
At least they move. Now, of course, you know, one can imagine that the Kuiper Belt objects don't move fast enough to be eliminated. This is the difference in these two images is about 6 hours. So a few days would be necessary for Kuiper Belt objects. Thank goodness they're all very faint and not coming up to peak at this wavelength because of where they are in distance from the sun. Okay, well, this is not Paul's picture. This is our picture that was put together with our bonus wavelength, 160 microns. Now, the MIPS arrays, you take 24, 70, and 160 microns simultaneously. But the 160 micron array is just two rows with a dead row in between them, and thus you don't get a filled image when you sweep across the sky one time. Now we come back to do it a second time to get our asteroids at 24 microns, try to fill in those gaps, and then we smooth this a bit. But so at any point on this image, the exposure time is either 3 seconds or nothing. So for 3 seconds, it's doing pretty well.
Where's the fish hook?
It's over in here. Yeah. So you see the little burned out areas here are the only places where we're actually saturated in TARS. There are not too many spots that we saturate. Now this one is the full 44 square degree image. So we put the TARS 2 survey filling in the spot bill, 1536 cloud down in there.
Is this the final image, or is there a chance that these gaps are in the middle of the initial?
The gaps in the middle, yes. We have actually gotten some time from the director of the SSE, who wants to have a press release for these big pictures, but doesn't want them to have nasty little gaps in them to fill in some of the gaps. So I think we're going to fill in this one and maybe this one over here at 160. It's much worse at IRAC. Unfortunately, this is IRAC, and we haven't done all of our magic to all of the strips from TARS 2, so they're still looking messy with big gradients in them and so forth, and latent images. But you can sort of see how it's going to fit together in the end. Again, this is the full 44 square degrees, and don't ask what these guys are because they just got left.
Is this sort of glow still artifact, or is that real?
These glows are artifacts. You mean this glow? This is again the Zodi band coming up at 8 microns. It hasn't been removed from the IRAC data, but it's again bringing up the brightness level across that part of the image.
What's the effective resolution at 160 microns?
It's 40 arc seconds. That is our beam size. Now we smoothed it by a factor of 2 or something to try to fill in the little gaps in the coverage. Okay, and this is a 3-band MIPS map. 70 microns is very striking, as people have seen before. It's hard to get rid of all of the hysteresis and memory effect artifacts. In fact, these guys here are the spin flash latents left behind. But you can see the 160 and some of the bright young stellar object sources lighting up pretty nicely.
What's that white thing down there?
Oh, this is the B star that's not supposed to be there, but that is behind the cloud. Just speaking of the first 30 square degree area, we've gotten our first version of the catalog done. In fact, we did it twice because some of the photometry wasn't very good. It's hard with just two coverages with IRAC to get rid of all the cosmic rays and to get a good value for its photometry. So we are on the verge of releasing a catalog at 15 signal with 188,000 sources in it. It's band merged through all of the MIPS and IRAC bands plus two masks added in there. So in a week or two, one should be able to pull that out of the SFC. But these are just the numbers. You get something at 10 sigma, about 500,000 sources over this area, something down to about 10,000 at MIPS 24, 570 microns. 160 microns, we didn't even go and pull the point sources out because it just was... the fun thing about this is that with some of these other big surveys coming online, we are collaborating with the Sloan folks and the folks with CFHT and XMM. So our team has a band merge catalog of all those things. So anyone who wants to come by my office and see pages and pages and pages and pages of SEDs can do that. Because within the past week or two, we've just exploded in the amount of data we've got. So here is at least a subsample of some of the objects, and Neil went through a lot of this on Monday, but in the IRAC color plot, your stars are around here at zero. You get a lot of extragalactic objects in this area and also some up here. Classical Petari stars are in this zone. Some of the things that have no inner disk but might have a disk hole might lurk around in here. But the big problem, of course, is the extragals are in the entire color plot, at least for IRAC. This is a group of objects which are known young stellar objects in Taurus. This is from the Hartman et al. GTO work. And they found that the weak-line Petari stars, at least in IRAC, most of them didn't have any evidence of excess emission in the IRAC bands, and then the classical stars were out here. And then there were models and individual objects for class one that lurk up in that area. This is another type of plot that we've used a lot to try to use the brightness of sources at 24 microns to kind of distinguish them from the extragalactic background. This is what this plot K versus K minus 24 looks like for the Swire, one of the Swire survey regions. You get galaxies down here, you get stars here, and you get stars superposed with galaxies to some extent in this area. And you can see that Taurus has a big population here that doesn't exist in Swire, but that anything that lurks down here in the red points show objects which have been identified as young stars of some sort in Taurus by previous workers, mostly with spectroscopy. And some of the faint ones are right down in here with the galaxies. So those form the real challenge. So using two mass and Spitzer and using all the same criteria that the C2D team was using to isolate a nice box of objects that would exclude almost all of the galaxies in that Swire field, we took our 40 objects to the Keck telescope last February and saw a lot of galaxies. And part of the reason for this is that with something that is as large as 30 or 40 square degrees, we are starting to pick up some of the rare extragalactic objects, EULERs and Edron AGN, that are not as common in the small 5-degree field that we were comparing against. So what we've decided is that morphological information is very important. At least in Taurus, it's possible because we aren't looking through hundreds of magnitudes of optical extinction. We're just looking through a few magnitudes in most areas. So now we're starting to use the deep optical images to help distinguish the extragalactic vermin from the young stellar objects that we want to see. And our preliminary assessment is that we will have at least 20 or 30 new sources, probably in the original area, and maybe 10 or 15 from the new area. So something like 50 to 100 sources is not out of the question for Taurus. A lot of these will be very low mass objects, the brown dwarf population. I'll talk a little more about them. Here are the complementary data sets that we are putting together with these things, and we're just starting to put it all into context. Unfortunately, except for CFH, which we were collaborating with from the beginning, the footprint of their large surveys don't completely overlap with ours. For example, Sloan is covering 48 square degrees in this area, but they don't cover all of our region. They only cover about two-thirds of it. So here are some of the SEDs, and like I said, hundreds and hundreds of pages of these with QMAS, IRAC, and MIPS wavelengths. And over here we have Sloan, and I don't think there are any of these. Some of these even have the XMM optical monitor brightnesses in there as well. And so you can see lots of different types of things. Something that looks more or less like a stellar photosphere here. Something with a disk, obviously. Flat objects that are pretty faint are usually galaxies, and everything in between.
Are they corrected from extinction?
No, these are not extinction corrected at all yet, because we don't have spectral types for most of these things. These are mostly new sources. So here's a tool that we have for using the short band data to help us decide whether something is a galaxy or not. This one is pretty obvious. In the Sloan data and in CFH, it jumps out as being a galaxy with a big bulge and maybe some spiral arms around the edge. And here's one that looks point-like in all of those bands. So this one we would say, you know, if it's extragalactic, it's probably an AGN. So it's good enough to take home with us. And here is a known IRAC source. You can see in the optical band, there's almost nothing there. Just a little bit of reflected light. But then in IRAC, it's jumping out. This one is at the edge of our coverage, so we can see all the cosmic rays all over the place here because we only had one coverage. And then it MIPS, it's very bright. So when we have gone through a subsample of our YSO candidates and looked at each individual ones, or whether or not they are extended, and you can see Louisa did a lot of this recently. So these are ones that she pulled out as being real galaxies in an IRAC color plot. This is a group that are point-like, and so we've mostly cleaned out this area, but they're the AGN kind of lurk up in that zone too. And here we just add in all of the known YSOs as well, so the classical Q-Charlie stars are populating this area, and then you can get some class ones up in that zone. And the same thing for here. These are extragalactic objects. There are a few, some of these outliers. One of them I found with an edge-on disk, actually, that categorizes the galaxy. But then the YSOs are brighter in general, and then the known YSOs added into that. So as of yesterday, 419 YSO candidates in the entire 44 square degrees. 144 of the ones we've gone through are obvious resolved galaxies, leaves us with around close to 300. And of those, 104 aren't identified yet as being known YSOs. Now, if you're thinking about how many objects there are in Taurus, the YSOs that we see, number one, they aren't necessarily in our map because we don't cover L1551, where there are quite a few objects. We don't even cover T-Tauri. That's one of my great shame things for this. It's way down to the south. But it also, we're not talking about weak-line T-Tauri stars that don't have any disk emissions, just the objects that are disky that we can see. And here is something, this is IRAS 04302, which is an edge-on disk. It's a butterfly star that I showed earlier on one of the diagrams. And this is what the IRAS in MIPS SED does. And there's one QMAS point for it. It didn't even show up in Sloan. It's off CFHD. And there are lots and lots of galaxies, or lurgs and new lurgs, that are popping up at in the MIP stands. This one turns over a little earlier than 04302, but the same morphology is pretty common amongst extragalactic sources. So they're fuzzy in these bands. They've got the double peak structure, so it's really hard, and they're faint, so it's really hard to distinguish them from the vermin, which is frustrating. Oh, yeah, there it is. So as for the distribution of YSOs in Taurus compared to Perseus, well, here's Perseus, and we have 24 micron sources plotted all over the place, and the little pluses here show the sources with excess that fulfill the YSO criteria that Neil had described. And this was sort of a first shot at one of our groups of YSO candidates for Taurus. And you can see there are little areas where there are strings of sources in an L1495. This isn't the whole 44 square degree. But there are a lot of things scattered around too. And until we get all the galaxies out of it, I can't make any more firm a conclusion than that.
The dots are all the sources?
The dots are all the 24 microns.
So do you know which of these crosses were the known ones and which of them were the potentially?
Not on this particular. not on this particular plot, but we're working on producing all of this for our poster and as Louisa's paper, and she's writing the paper on the old and new population of Taurus. So she's in.
So you mean old is in the literature and new?
Old is in the literature and new is in this stuff. Here are some examples of the HH objects that are seen in our images. Again, we get some of these big outflows, and we're going to the telescope shortly. So here are some of the science topics that people are working on papers about, and all of these are going to be posters at the AAAS. I think we have something like 20 posters that are associated with this project that are going to be the special session, so I hope to see many of you there, and we can hopefully do more science at that point. So, and here are some pictures from the Sloan survey that Jill has provided for us. Some HH objects in Sloan, and one of the most interesting parts of the Sloan survey is that there's a spectroscopic component that was looking for, started out being sort of a calibration exercise to get M stars so that they could work on their techniques for figuring out extinction. But many of these sources have H alpha emission and low gravity indicators. So this is a way of looking for potentially young stars that do not have excess emission. So something like half the ones that she originally, a smaller fraction. So 20 out of 80 that were originally given to us to look at the SEDs had excess, but some of the others may be new weak ones, Taurus stars. They have to be looked at higher resolution to find out. This is the background picture, which has come from the Sloan survey. The CFHT survey is largely a brown dwarf search, but it has wonderful seeing from Mauna Kea and very accurate photometry, so we've put that into our survey as well. Here are some of the brown dwarf candidates that were identified from the CFH survey, and we now have the SEDs for them, and about half of them, just like the stars are thought to about half, have excess. About half the brown dwarf candidates have excess. And those have all been spectroscopically confirmed, so they really are brown dwarfs. ZEST has been around for a while. It's a large program with XMM Newton, about 5 square degrees in Taurus, and they had a big special issue of ANA recently talking about their sources. We looked at the same group of brown dwarfs, and they detected the brighter part of that population. It didn't correlate at all with the excess sources. And Paul, here's a familiar picture of yours, and just to show there is a 160 micron map. Yeah, slowly, because it's a big picture. But you can see the cavity quite nicely in here. you know, and some of the more excitable people on our team have even got, you know, said, ooh, they've got little striations pointing towards the middle. But, you know, we haven't found any lurking neutron stars or anything. I think I'm a bit surprised the heck out of everyone if there was an actual massive star event that happened in Taurus. But it is an interesting little hole, and we see it in lots of different bands. So, in summary, these five large area surveys, we're trying to bring all the data together, and we've gotten a good start on that. We've got a big catalog. Some of these surveys will be going public shortly. Exynem, we're going to release their data along with ours, and we're working on the Sloan data. It will be publicly available shortly, if not already. We're working on the CFHT folks to do the same thing. And so I think this is a great resource for people who are working in the Taurus area. And we're not finished with Taurus yet. The WISE mission that will launch in 2009 is going to map the whole sky at these wavelengths. And the sensitivity is not quite as good as Spitzer, within a factor of few of these large area shallow surveys with Spitzer. So we will finally get to connect the dots for all of the regions to the south and Taurus that we haven't picked up with Spitzer yet. So thank you.
You mentioned that the results on the brown dwarfs have already been published. Could you tell us what the highlights of that?
Okay, so the brown dwarfs, the primary gist of that paper was all of the candidates that were identified by CFH, they followed it up and spectroscopically identified. So for the ones that were spectroscopically confirmed and were within our map, we compared, we looked at the SEDs for these guys, and half of them were objects with this.
So, and I'm just wondering, in terms of the numbers for the IMF, are there any results on that, you know, what's the ratio? Have we learned anything new about the ratio of brown dwarfs to Mancini?
I think at one point there was the worry that some of the brown dwarfs were missing out of Taurus, that it didn't seem to have quite as many as some of the other regions. And when a larger area survey was done, not just focusing in on the densest part of the gas, those guys seemed to have shown up. So I think there's not as much of a deficit of brown dwarfs as originally thought. And in Taurus, the ones with this seem to be a little more clustered than the others, are sticking towards the area of the 13CO, but it's pretty small number statistics. We're only talking about 30 or 40 objects here in total, of which about half of them have this.
What's the minimum gas that you would be sensitive to in this survey?
You know, theoretically speaking, we can pick up something that is that's well below the hydrogen burning limit, but just in IRAC bands 1 and 2. Now, whether we would identify as anything interesting at that point, probably not. So all of the brown dwarfs that have shown up here are things that are looking like N-stars, right? So they've got spectral types of N6 or later. We don't have anything that is low enough mass to look like a T-dwarf, although we are theoretically capable of finding a T-dwarf type of thing, at least in band 2. But a single band source is not given very much attention yet in our survey, and it's going to be hard for us in the end with all the lack of redundancy. It's something that can be done better if Taurus is revisited in the WARM mission. We've thought about doing that to get proper motions, perhaps.
So you have a complete IMF then for Taurus now with all of these new data?
We will. I can't claim that we have one that's completely worked out, but our goal is to get a complete census for the areas. But it, you know, we're going to need to do spectroscopic follow-up on a lot of these things to know exactly where they fit. Go ahead.
I have a question on the expressor series. You said that there is no coincidence. I briefly saw that there is no coincidence with infrared excess subsea.
Oh, for the X-ray?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Is it because there is a lot of variability in the X-ray sources?
I think it's basically it's sort of a luminosity effect. And I mean, what it looks like here is that the bright stars are the ones that they are the bright substellar objects are the ones that they are detecting. Now, some of these things, of course, all of the X-ray sources are highly variable. And this, while the survey with ZEST went on over 30K seconds, that's not forever. And so it's not like POO, where you could watch it for a week, and sometimes it would flare and sometimes they wouldn't. They may not have caught them in a, you know, flaring time. So some of these things might have shown up if we looked at it for long enough.
But I let Tom switch in his computer and then dedicate
him. Sure.
But I think that's mostly a sensitivity effect.
Yes.
In the XM survey, there was a paper where they actually found, you know, about 100 or 70 candidates from the X-ray data as new members, potential new members of the... Have you correlated...
We have, yes, we have band merged them, and we've got them sitting in a big file right now, and Manuel is presenting that paper in Austin, but I don't know what the answer is yet. Okay, I do know that my own browsing through the XMM source catalog that has all of these wonderful SCDs in them doesn't reveal to me a whole lot of objects with disks that don't already have identifications. So there are a lot of AGN that are in there. There are a lot of galaxies that are so faint that we only get bands 1 and 2 of IRAC for them. So it will be interesting to see what new sources. But I would guess that a lot of the newish objects that they're getting are going to be weak line stars that don't have X-ray. Which is good, because those
so
are the ones we don't know.
More candidate.
That's right. That would be more of a population, more of a distal population of TARS.
Right. Okay.